I'm Steve Lascazo, and this is The Way. You're listening to This is The Way podcast's discussion of Ahsoka, Season 1, Episode 4. Fallen Jedi is the title of Part 4. A little about me. I started podcasting because I had left the broadcasting business and been out of it a few years, and I wanted to hone some of the skills I'd learned as a sports anchor and reporter, and I liked Star Wars. There was this new show coming out, The Mandalorian. Well, since the debut of Disney Plus, I've podcasted about several Star Wars shows on this channel, and for a little while I was covering Marvel's Phase 4 on a separate podcast too. My goal with today's podcast, the one you're listening to right now, is to enjoy my time speculating about where this story of Ahsoka is heading, and to share that excitement with others. Since I consume a lot of Star Wars content, I want to use that knowledge to help explain what's happening on screen for people who might not keep up with it in all its forms. Ahsoka premiered with two episodes on the same day, August 22nd, 2023, but the next week and then this week, and until all eight episodes are out, the show will stream weekly on Tuesdays, one at a time. Dave Filoni is responsible for creating the character of Ahsoka, and he's now the unofficially official caretaker. He's understandably protective of his creation, especially since none other than George Lucas himself hand-picked Filoni's drawing to be the model for Anakin Skywalker's apprentice. That's a big deal. And then it became his apprentice in the Clone Wars movie and animated series. Lucas also basically handpicked Filoni to be his spiritual successor for protecting the direction of Star Wars. Filoni's friendship with Jon Favreau is what led to the creation of The Mandalorian. But not just that, it was his support that brought the weight of Lucasfilm into action and really has had an uplifting effect for the brand on Disney+. Filoni is the creator of the Ahsoka character and the show. He's the showrunner. He directed the premiere and will be credited with directing Episode 5 as well, and now we know why Episode 5 is such a big deal. Filoni also gets sole writing credit for all eight episodes of the season.
Just pointing it out.
Peter Ramsey directed Episode 4. His first Star Wars work came in The Mandalorian Season 3, Episode 5, The Pirate. He is perhaps most famous, though, for his work in animated features, one of which was the very largely successful Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. The end credit sequence, not the theme, but the sequence, the graphics, it's a creation of You and Company. Y-U and Company. You can listen to This is the Way podcast episode 137 for a list of all the translated runes, but I recommend searching YouTube for visual translations if you're truly interested. Playing over that sequence is Kevin Kiner's end credit Ahsoka theme, and it is available to stream on most music services and YouTube. The runtime shows up as 41 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page, but say it with me now, it's not how long it takes if you're only interested in action. From first shot to cut to credits actually runs 33 minutes 12 seconds. If you do only watch that much, you're going to miss a little of the audio ambiance before the show begins, you know, during the Lucasfilm and Star Wars helmets sequence. And then this also imagines a world where you're not waiting to hear even just a couple of the notes of the Vader theme after the cut to black. You're also probably not going to turn off the credit sequence, at least not yet. I don't think it's become annoying yet, but maybe you're one of the handful of people that don't like it. So the first episode was a little over 50 minutes, the second under 37, the third less than half an hour, and in part four we're back over half an hour, a little over 33 minutes. The description of the episode reads, Hera risks her career to help her friends while Ahsoka and Sabine confront enemies. And that's not the best description of what happens in the episode, but I guess that is spoiler-free. Director of photography is Eric Steelberg, who was co-DP in episode 2, but he's back to taking care of things solo like he was in the premiere. Production design is back in the hands of the Andrew L. Jones and Doug Chang duo. Editor, Dana E. Glauerman. She's back after she was there for episode 1 and then someone else took care of episodes 2 and 3. Makeup designers for all 4 episodes so far have been Alexei Dimitriou and Christina Waltz. Alexei has worked on The Mandalorian, The Book of Boba Fett, Marvel movies and shows, and Star Trek Picard. I think his experience with alien creature makeup and prosthetics is probably what led to this Ahsoka gig. And Christina worked with him at least on The Mandalorian 3rd season and also on Star Trek Picard. Additional voices credited as David W. Collins, Terry Douglas, Robin Atkin-Downs, Helen Sadler, Sam Witwer, Matthew Wood, who also takes care of a lot of the sound supervision for the show, and Shelby Young. And I didn't have to change a thing about that note from last episode, so it's identical, that list, to episode 3. Okay, we've reached the cast section.
What's your name, son?
Ahsoka Tano is played in live action, of course, by Rosario Dawson. Natasha Lou Bordizzo plays Sabine Wren. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is New Republic General and Ace Pilot Hera Syndulla. Ray Stevenson is Baylan Skoll, the most interesting man in Ahsoka. His apprentice, Shin Hati, is played by Ivana Sakno. Diana Lee Inosanto is the Night Sister of Dathomir descendant Morgan Elsbeth. She, like Dawson's, reprising her role that we first saw her play in live action during Chapter 13, The Jedi, in the second season of The Mandalorian. David Tennant provides the voice for Hu Yang, a 25,000-plus-year-old droid that once served the Jedi Order as a lightsaber architect, and Tennant also voiced the character in animation in The Clone Wars. Evan Witten plays Jacen Syndulla, son of the deceased Jedi Padawan Kanan Jarrus, no spoilers, and, of course, Hera. And at the very end of the episode, we are treated to the return of Anakin Skywalker, played by a digitally de-aged Hayden Christensen.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating, and it gets everywhere.
Back again from episode 3 is First Officer Vic Hawkins. He's again played by Nikan Robinson. Back from The Mandalorian and The Book of Boba Fett is Captain Carson Teva.
I need you to send us a ping.
So glad to have Paul Sun-Hyung Lee show up and be part of this story as well. Joining him on Hera's Phoenix Squadron as X-Wing pilots was Lieutenant Basie. That is Michael C. Alexander getting his first Star Wars credit with the role. Lieutenant Mawat is the Rodian. How do I know that? Well, it's the alien character species that looks like Greedo from A New Hope. So you know that this had to be Dawn Dininger. She's played many a Rodian for Favreau and Filoni on Disney+. Just last episode, she was credited with the Mon Cala pilot, though, standing next to Vic Hawkins in that episode. Lieutenant Gensu is a stunt double for Sabine on this show. She earns a live-action gig and character comic convention status with that role, doesn't she? She can charge more for autographs now. That is Chow Nomova. And another X-Wing pilot of the Phoenix Squadron to mention, and it's Din Djarin. Well, okay, not actually. It is Brendan Wayne, who inhabits the suit for a lot of the acting portions when Pedro Pascal is not in that suit. Lateef Crowder, the other man who inhabits the Mandalorian's Beskar suit of armor, hasn't gotten an on-screen live-action character yet. I think we need to see him next. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he has appeared and I just haven't seen him. And finally, Paul Darnell is not just performance capture for Marok. He played the part. And, as suspected, this is just some random bad guy cool enough to have a name. This is not Ezra, and it's not Starkiller. It's not Kanan Jarrus reanimated from the dead. It's not Darth Maul. It's none of those. It might be a dead Knight Brother from Dathomir, but it's just Marak. Oh, one more note. Shockingly, Christopher Bartlett is not performance capturing any droids this episode. Nicole Botello is credited as the power droid, which I'm guessing is one of those ones on Elsbeth's ship that's docked with the Eye of Sion.
Exactly.
He can go about his business.
You can go about your business.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
We have the Disney snap, previously on, Lucasfilm Limited logo, Star Wars helmet sequence, and we're back on CTUS. Ahsoka's shuttle's in bad shape, and true to Star Wars form, everyone on board can always fix the issue without major repairs whenever they're stranded and wherever they're stranded. This time it's Hu Yang trying to fix communications that were jammed when coming in range of the planet, but now suddenly it's damage that's the problem? Remember, Hera cut out on the transmission last episode because they were approaching and there was some jamming problems from either CTOS or the Eye of Sion. Apparently, Dave Filoni didn't remember that. Maybe he wrote these episodes out of order. Maybe he just wasn't careful. Small thing. Yes, I know. But small things should be the easiest to fix before you get to the shooting stage, shouldn't they? There's two ways to fix it. One, tell us in the opening scene that since we can't fly out, Hu Yang thinks, hey, I got a way to boost the communications relay and actually get a signal out. Two, show us last episode, during the comms talk with Hera, it was the ship getting fired upon that knocked out communication, which explains why they're working on that now. Well, Filoni did neither. I'm on board for the droid lightsaber smith knowing how to fix a ship that he's spent less than 10 of his 25,000 years of his existence flying, but, you know, I catch those other little things.
Comms are still down and the primary power converter is offline. We can't send a distress signal and our ship isn't going anywhere.
Hu Yang said their ground base isn't far. Start there.
Oh, communications are down, but we can scan the planet, huh? And there's a base now? Or they called it a base? It looked like a bunch of ships landing near a bunch of stones. If they had said, hey, it seems like we're a half dozen miles from the coastline, or there's some strange power readings in this direction, maybe that would have worked better, especially in the next scene when Shin Hati says, hey, the Jedi ship is about 12 clicks away. That's almost 7.5 miles. Ahsoka has almost already given up on the mission.
The enemy has the map and the means to get where they want to go. I fear we face a difficult choice. Which is, if we can't make the journey to find Ezra, then no one should.
It won't come to that.
It might have already.
He'd be stranded out there. Maybe this time for good.
Better that than allowing Thrawn's return as heir to the Empire.
Let's find that ground base.
Sabine. Can I count on you?
You know you can.
Well, that's just what you want to hear from your mentor, right? Might be the truth, but Debbie Downer over here is preparing her Padawan. If I can't have it, no one can. Sounds much more like the Sith than that other controversial line from the most unwatchable Star Wars movie about, hey, we're going to win because we save what we love, not by killing what we hate.
One does not speak unless one knows.
That may actually be our first indication Ahsoka is mingling a bit more than we're used to with the dark side of the Force. I mean, she's not a Jedi. She left that order. But, I mean, Sabine isn't ready to forego her attachment to Ezra. That's also a dark side mentality. And like Padawan, like Master. Speaking of, Baylan Skoll gets word from Shin that the spacecraft has been found in the forest, and he wants to get a move on.
Is that a note of fear in your voice?
Experience.
That scene leads into the title card, which shows us it's called Fallen Jedi. Not Fallen Order, but Jedi. And this could refer to a few different people we see in the episode, and I do mean see. Could be Baylan. He mentions he was once part of the Order. Could be Ahsoka. Well, we know her situation. It could also mean the most fallen of them all, the one called Vader. After the slate, we get some tense footage of Hu Yang working outside the ship while mercenaries start circling. Inside, Sabine is frantically searching for a blast part or something. Some part of her blaster, maybe. Ahsoka notices, helps her out. But then she doubles down and points out the obvious to Sabine.
I know how much Ezra means to you. Sometimes we have to do what's right, regardless of our personal feelings.
You really believe that?
When the stakes are this high, I have to.
On the one hand, it's somewhat understandable that a Jedi brought up, raised in the Order, would be oblivious to the feelings others would have. But on the other hand, when we see stories about Jedi and Padawan, the Jedi is always reminding the Padawan, you have to suppress those feelings of attachment. Ahsoka, however, is no ordinary Jedi, and her master is kind of infamous. She not only left the Order because of how it treated her when someone framed her for a bombing in the Jedi Temple, she has been on her own long enough to see not everyone has the capability to use the Force in a way that makes detachment the best way forward in all scenarios. Sometimes you sacrifice for the greater good, and sometimes you're only able to make that call because your friendships and family inspire you to that. That's really not the case here. I mean, Sabine is just missing Ezra. But the point remains, and it's kind of tone deaf at best, coming from Ahsoka here, moments after asking if she could count on Sabine, so basically she's questioning her loyalty. I mean, we find out there's reason, right? Back outside, Hu Yang finishes one repair and then hears a noise and he's attacked. The fact the ship takes more damage is what alerts Ahsoka, not the Force? I mean, Hu Yang even cries for help. He literally says, help. And that's the best a droid can do?
Help!
Help! Help! Help!
It's not that I have a problem with one thing or the other. It's both. Ahsoka doesn't sense anything, and all Hu Yang does is cry help. And he's able to be muffled by the attacking droid's mechanical hand. I went back and I looked, and at first I thought, oh, well, Hu Yang knocked out the power himself to let them know inside something was wrong, but I don't think that's what happened. I went back and looked. I don't think it's even that the attacker pushed him back into the wiring. I think he just backed up into it with his third and fourth arms.
That daft droid made it worse.
He wouldn't.
The fight is on. Ahsoka and Sabine descend the steps and into battle. It's not a long one here. It's got some great teamwork. The henchmen are easily dispatched. Hu Yang is okay, but the ship's going to take a little bit more work. And in the meantime, Sabine and Ahsoka are going to head off on a bit of a run. 12 kilometers or so from what Shin mentioned.
May I make one request of you both? Stay together. You always did better that way, in my opinion.
We better get moving.
Together.
Oh, very good.
Back on Home One, we see Hera's taking matters into her own hands. She's heading toward the ghost in the hangar with her son and Chopper. She's bringing Jason? Why? If she really believes help is needed, she's going to put her son in danger? Maybe we're going to find out she's been training him to do something, or that she knows that he has this innate ability like his father that will come in useful. But she's not exercising good judgment, and I don't just mean the leaving without permission part. I mean, Hawkins tells her she can't just leave with a meeting of the General Staff coming up, and she says, watch me. No wonder Chopper has such an attitude. I'm kind of surprised Jason doesn't exhibit that behavior openly as well. They get on board, And she tells him, buckle up, and he asks naively and almost politely why he has to follow orders and she doesn't. Chopper says, because she's the boss, and she points out what we knew last episode, but she seemed to forget momentarily. She's a general and a hero of the rebellion. I saw on Reddit something about a photo in the cockpit of Kanan, and there is something there in the shot right before they all get inside, but even on the biggest screen I have in my house, I cannot tell for sure who it is, and I'm not going to go through all this digital reconstruction. There's a chance that we get a closer shot of that picture since it is there in the scene. I mean, it was placed there digitally. Who else is she going to have there but her husband, right? Can neither confirm nor deny, and we may never get an answer on why they have printed photographs on paper in Star Wars.
Thanks for joining the party, Carson.
Wouldn't miss it, General.
Carson Teva. Love that character. Yeah, I know Paul Sun Hyung Lee follows us, but he follows us because we liked him first and then kept posting on how much we liked him in the character. We don't like him just because he follows the podcast. 2 seasons of The Mandalorian with an expanded role in Season 3 and an appearance in The Book of Boba Fett as well for Carson Teva, and now in Ahsoka. We didn't get to see him in Obi-Wan Kenobi or Andor, but my wife can tell you, I cheered out loud when Hera said his name, even before he appeared on the screen. The rest of the X-Wing pilots, they're kind of like Star Trek red shirts, but just as I'm admitting I cheered out loud for him, I also ended up saying out loud to no one in particular, you better not hurt my captain.
You know, you're risking an awful lot by doing this.
Well, you know how it is. Once a rebel, always a rebel.
On your signal, Phoenix leader.
I loved that line, and I loved seeing the squadron hitting hyperspace, and I liked that Jason enjoyed being the one to punch it. There is a lot to love in this show. But all of those great lines don't erase some of the problems that I end up having. Okay, back on Cetus. Elsbeth is staring out at the clouds with Baylan. I guess maybe they're star whale watching. What the scene is missing is someone, anyone, telling him, hey, the process is ready. Because it sure seems like a waste of time that they suddenly just figure out, okay, now's the time when we're going to start the ticking clock. You know, one robotic voice was all we needed saying, you know, we're ready to begin, Lady Elsbeth. Or even just a series of beeps or something that we can infer that some process had completed and they're ready to go. It's those little things that keep getting missed. In this same scene, we get a cheesy, but hey, still very cool line from Baylan. Elsbeth tells them, have faith that their calculations won't leave them stranded in the void of space between galaxies.
Faith. I lost that a long time ago.
I do wonder, though, how do they know these hyperspace lanes between galaxies never have any obstructions? It is a huge void, but I mean, there's nobody maintaining them or taking trips in them. This is a huge, huge void. Also, if you get stuck out there, you don't just pilot back along the same course, do you? Or if your calculations are a little off, do you do your best and just course correct toward the only spot of light that you see? I would think it would be infinitely more difficult if instead of a void, there were scattered star systems along the route. I mean, then you're, you know, a point of light is just one of hundreds of thousands. And, you know, not every galaxy or every planet is inhabitable, or, you know, it's not necessarily that they could get help from all of these random star systems. I mean, you may never get back to this galaxy or to the one that you want, so I suppose that is a frightening thought. But these are people who engage hyperdrives, you know, once a week at least for most of their lives, right? It's like Star Trek and transporters. You know, use that one thing one time. And are you sure you're ever the same person ever again?
Witchcraft.
Calculating hyperspace coordinates.
The thrum of the machinery lets you know it's working. Sabine and Ahsoka are on their 7.5-mile fun run to benefit Ezra Bridger. Man, if there's only a Mandalorian with a jetpack, No. House Ren, I guess, swore those things off or something? I don't know why she doesn't have one. Shin Hati and Marak just happened to pick a place somewhere along the route, and boy, aren't they lucky that Sabine and Ahsoka hustle to that very spot and then slow down when they spot them with their eyes and not, say, the rangefinder in Sabine's helmet, Ahsoka's force capabilities, or, you know, see them farther off. Again, I'm not looking for everything to make sense, but I can think of something in just 2 seconds. And just, if you're left wondering why the writer, in this case Filoni, doesn't just come up with something a little bit more sensible, you know, why not just have some kind of a ravine that they have to cross? And then that's a choke point, right? Like, they have to cross this ravine at this place, and then that makes perfect sense. Shin and Marak would lay in wait on either side of it. Well, the answer to that's probably it would have been harder for the volume, I guess. And I admit, I don't know if Filoni wrote something like that in, and then someone with the budget said, nah, too expensive. You know, let's just have it in a big forest. But unfortunately, I can only judge by what I see, not by guessing.
Going somewhere?
The fights that ensue are pretty cool. But remember, this is a force user against what we'll find out later is a force-using ghost that has the power of speech too, and then it's between a force user that has only trained under Baylan, so primarily Darkseid, against a Padawan who maybe not doesn't even have trace amounts of midichlorians, right? It should be a quick fight on both fronts. Actually, Shin and Sabine from blasters out to wrist rockets, knocking the saber out of Shin's hand, is less than 9 minutes. Ahsoka cuts down or open Marak in about 2. And most of that was probably just circling and waiting for their, you know, lightsaber battle to begin. I mean, it's not a spoiler to reveal this. This is the point of the podcast. The fighting choreography is cool. I liked the duels very much. Marak, though, as he's split open, is revealed to be a Night Sister magic creation or embodiment. That is not new to Star Wars. It is absolutely the first time we see it in live action. Although, it was Elsbeth questioning Baylan, can Marak finish the mission, right? Marak is extremely agile. He can speak, even if it's through the helmet he wears, and he's able to use the Force. But that green smoke, that says to me Night Sister magic. And it's one of those things, it works in animation, not really in live action. Not because it's not cool. It raises more questions here than is worth introducing. Still, his death is surprising and cool to watch. We probably will never find out where he got the Inquisitor blade. The green smoke escapes the saber slash to his chest with this high-pitched exploding hiss and screams, according to the closed captioning. And then Shin is surprised Ahsoka won. Really? I mean, really? Her surprise should come from the fact that she's still battling Sabine.
Go! Get the map! Got this.
No, Sabine, no, you really don't. It does pay off that line from Hu Yang, though, about not splitting up. There is no reason Ahsoka should just allow this non-force-wielding Padawan in a one-on-one fight with Shin. Together, they could easily beat her, Mandalorian and former Jedi. They could both reach Baylan, and even if one then fights him while the other secured the map, that would have been worth it. Heck, they could have both run for the map right then and then let Shin race after them, and it still makes more sense considering Ahsoka's attachment to her Padawan that she reveals later.
You will regret this decision.
I mean, someone's going to regret that decision. Baylan is left at the stone circle by Elsbeth, who's preparing for departure. Moments later, Ahsoka comes upon the illuminated map, sees Elsbeth heading toward the Eye of Sion on her ship, and here is another point of contention for me. Why not start destroying some of the computers and monitoring equipment that's set up around the stones to calculate things? If accuracy of the calculations is so important, it would seem that even one machine being destroyed would call into question those calculations, wouldn't it? It would at least delay things. I double-checked, and yes, there are readings on her ship being reported by one of the protocol droids, but Elsbeth, before leaving, looks at a console on the planet amid the stones. Ahsoka didn't even need to destroy the map. She just needed to destroy the equipment to buy time.
Anakin spoke highly of you.
Interesting. He never mentioned you.
Everyone in the Order knew Anakin Skywalker. Few would live to see what he became. Surely that must leave a mark. Is that why you walked away? Abandoned him?
The prelude to the Master's lightsaber duel once again makes me far more interested in Baylan's past than I feel like even Filoni intended. He knew Anakin, Baylan. But just when I think maybe he's referring to having known him while he was Vader or something, maybe he was some kind of numbered inquisitor down the line, well, he reveals everyone in the Order knew of him, so he's probably talking about pre-Order 66 Anakin. He goads Ahsoka, but at this point, she's been burying that past. Maybe when he was sitting there meditating, he was sensing all of this.
I'm not here to discuss my past.
The only reason I'm here is to secure the future.
For you?
Something far greater.
Ambitious.
Necessary.
And you find starting another war necessary?
I'm not starting a war. But Thrawn will. It is an unfortunate evil, but speaks to a greater truth. One must destroy in order to create.
Ahsoka's line is so poignant because of what we see at the end of the episode. Baylan's line is so interesting because a little later he'll accuse Ahsoka of being destructive, but it works with the disappointment on his face when Ahsoka ends up lighting her lightsaber.
How inevitable.
In my opinion, I think Baylan was getting ready to make his pitch for the dark side to Ahsoka, maybe even offering her a chance to meet her master in the world between worlds, if that's his goal. This is a Force user that talks about power being the ultimate endgame. What if the new world he's envisioning is Force users on top, everyone else a slave? I mean, we haven't heard his manifesto yet.
The Jedi has engaged Lord Baylan at the Henge.
How long until we receive the final coordinates?
Moments.
Moments? Come on, Filoni, droids don't estimate like that. The fight between Ahsoka and Baylan is great. They seem equally matched. They're using different fighting styles, and there's some Force use thrown in, literally, when Baylan throws that small boulder at her that she cuts in half. The fight between Sabine and Shin is still going on. We do see that she's left her helmet behind in the middle of the forest somewhere. I hope someone picks it up later for her, because, honestly, that Beskar helmet would be quite useful. Shin even punches her in the face in a moment. It even leads to one of the best lines from Shin, one we saw in a trailer or clip. Sabine gets punched, loses her saber, kicked to the ground, but before the killing blow can be administered, Sabine throws up her hand, and I absolutely love the direction to Ivana Sokno, the actress, to avert her eyes in anticipation of the Force being used. Maybe that was the closest that Sabine ever got to using the Force, and so Shin senses this slightest of efforts, but then realizing there's nothing there.
You have no power.
That, my friends, is King Theoden's line to a wizard in Edoras, minus the word here.
You have no power here, Gandalf the Grey.
Sabine, however, didn't plan on using the Force. She's taken a cue from Fenn Rau, using what she knows. That's someone who talked to her during Rebels when she was training with Kanan. He told her, you know, use what you know. Well, wrist rockets fire out at Shin. She actually disarms her, as in her saber deflects the rockets from hitting her face. But there are multiple projectiles coming out of that wrist thing, and she can't defend against the ones hitting the saber hilt, and maybe also her arm and maybe her hand. Here, writer Filoni and director Ramsey use our expectations to one-up our imaginations. We agree with Shin in a sense, except in doing so, we admit we equate power with ability in the Force. So while that duel is wrapping up, Ahsoka takes her turns with Force kicks, and actually kicking and knocking Baylan to the ground. For some reason, she actually uses her actual hand instead of the Force to grab the headpiece to the Staff of Ra. I mean, the map sphere. And just like one of those Raiders of the Lost Ark antagonists Major Arnold Ernst taught, she's left with this smoking hand. Maybe it has part of the map on it?
Your legacy, like your master's, was one of death and destruction.
I don't really think so, but there was this... Well, shutting down the process seems to have charged the air around the henge or something, or maybe the electrical energy that was there producing the map actually occupied some space and wasn't just a projection, because thunder rolls. I didn't see any lightning, but thunder rolls, and it's loud enough for Shin and Sabine to hear it in the forest. It distracts Sabine long enough for Shin to pull out a ninja move. She throws a smoke bomb off her belt. To me, Shin would have just called her lightsaber to her offhand and sliced into the smoke, cutting Sabine in half. Instead, she just runs off. Baylan is going to make Ahsoka pay for her rashness.
That was unwise.
Huh. Sounds familiar.
You are unwise to lower your defenses.
Ahsoka is normally a dual wielder, two lightsabers, but even double-handing her katana-like long lightsaber would be formidable, but now in combat, she's only one-handed. Shin appears at the henge first. Ahsoka is distraught. Baylan orders Shin to get the map, but Ahsoka dips into the dark side and throws Shin against the rocks. That enrages Baylan, who two-hands his saber and knocks her back to the edge of the cliff that the henge sits above. Nothing below but rocks and water. Ahsoka would certainly die if she fell upon those rocks. Sabine then enters the fray. She survived. Ahsoka's glad. Ahsoka tells Sabine, "Destroy the map," but Sabine hesitates. That pays off lines from earlier about Ahsoka not being able to count on her if needed. Well, you know, she can't. There's something in their past that's destroyed trust. Maybe it's just Sabine has another attachment that is far stronger than Padawan to Master. Baylan doesn't care. Perhaps because he knows that a single blast from this pistol that Sabine is holding to the map wouldn't do anything. But it's really better this way than it would have been if Sabine tried blasting it and it didn't work. Ahsoka then just doesn't just fail. She fails spectacularly because her Padawan disobeys. And Baylan knocks Ahsoka off the cliff. And Sabine then tries blasting at Baylan. It is so effortless and cool the way he knocks back bolt after bolt. She should have listened to her master. But not because trying to destroy it would have worked. Baylan has this opening now. And he is cool and calm. He talks Sabine down.
I know you feel that Ezra Bridger... it's the only family you have left.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I know that's what's holding you back. Your family died on Mandalore because your master didn't trust you. You and I share a common goal: to make this journey. You to be reunited with your long-lost friend. And I to serve a greater good. Come with me. Willingly. Do it. For Ezra.
His moment of peace where he closes his eyes and senses everything he needs to know before calmly stowing away his lightsaber, then revealing everything in Sabine's soul. It's so cold and unnatural. He touches on every way the light has let her down, even though Sabine really doesn't know the light. He's promising her what her heart desires. Quintessential evil dressed in the guise of good. Just taste that apple. Everything will be all right. The long beat before she hands over the map is just the right length. Not too long. It's acted really well. Doesn't overstay its welcome a second, in my opinion.
Shin, release her. Shin. I gave her my word. And unlike her former master, I shall keep mine.
Then Shin tries force choking Sabine. I liked seeing this pettiness of Shin Hati. She probably heard all that honey from Balin Skull's lips directed towards Sabine Wren, and even if she knew it was all an act, she is disgusted by this girl's presence. Balin could absolutely just kill Sabine and be done with her, but he must sense it's worth keeping his word, even if killing her would mean no one but he and Shin would ever know.
Fulcrum, come in, over.
Yes, 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 affirmative. This is Fulcrum. We are downed on the surface of Cetos. Repeat, we are down. Can you send assistance, over?
Copy, Huyang, we're already here.
Now Hera shows up? There's not much left to do. Huyang tells them the hyperspace ring is complete, and that there is a hyperspace ring. They can't let it get away. Balin got the calculations restarted, and now those are complete. So Morgan Elsbeth calls upon them to get aboard the Eye of Sion. Balin plunges his lightsaber into the map sphere, and it takes a good while for the thing to come apart. I don't think a blaster bolt would have done it. Adding to that hopelessness of Sabine's effort to save Ahsoka from the edge.
Mark S4's in attack position.
Just a message, Chapinawi.
I don't think they're sticking around for a fight.
Captain Teva gets to deliver one of the most awesome lines an X-Wing pilot can. Harkening all the way back to the original movie. It's so awesome. Well, the Eye isn't launching fighters. As one of the lieutenants points out, they're not sticking around. Elsbeth tells her protocol droid to engage the hyperdrive and ignore the oncoming New Republic squadron.
Tracking six incoming New Republic craft. They are obstructing our path.
Hera!
Ignore them. Engage the hyperdrive.
Hera and Carson realize what's happening too late. Fortunately for them, unlike the, I don't even want to call it, the Holdo maneuver that destroys multiple ships for some reason, this ring only disrupts the space around the squadron, and some of the X-Wings crash into one another, and we lose the Rodian Lieutenant Mawat, Basie, I think Lander, played by Brendan Wayne. Only two are left, and one of them is Carson Teva, so the other might be Gensu, played by Sabine's stunt double Chow Namova. Anyway, the Eye of Sion is a big ring, it's hurtling through space, and it's on the way to Thrawn.
Mom? I've got a bad feeling.
I want to be mad that Jason gets this line, but he's probably the only Force-sensitive one left in that area. And it kind of makes sense, even though it's so painfully obvious. I mean, the thing is, he's a kid, and kids say painfully obvious things all the time. Episode over, right? No. Aerial tracking shot from the cliff Ahsoka fell over, and it is seamless, this transition to another world. A world between worlds, even. That is where Ahsoka finds herself. For Ezra in Rebels, he needed to open a doorway. In this case, it didn't seem like a doorway was needed. Ahsoka has died before. In fact, I think twice. The only thing missing from this shot, I think, was a Marai, which is like a bird-like creature that follows around. That would have sold the shot a little more to Rebels fans, in my opinion. Marai is this winged, owl-like creature that follows Ahsoka around because it's this representation of the spirit of the daughter, which is a godlike character she met with Obi-Wan and Anakin on the planet Mortis. It was a trippy episode, well, episode arc of the Clone Wars animated series. So, you know, if you don't understand, no wonder. All you need to know is there's this trinity of Force wielders somewhere in the galaxy, in the universe. They act almost like gods because they have this power of the light side and the dark side, the daughter and the son. And then there's this father figure that maintains balance between the two opposing forces. It's not really clear in the Clone Wars if that's a real place and a real thing, or if it's some manifestation of the Force. It's really kind of open-ended. You'd have to watch the Mortis arc to understand what I'm talking about, but they kind of like fall asleep in the ship, and then suddenly they're on this planet, and then they wait. When they wake up at the end of the arc, they're like, did that really happen? Okay, so that was in the Clone Wars. The son kills Ahsoka on Mortis, but the daughter infuses her spirit into Ahsoka, reviving her. I told you, it's trippy.
General Skywalker, come in.
We read you, Rex. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Standing by. We were worried.
You were off the scopes there for a moment.
A moment? We've been gone more than a moment, Rex.
Sir, I don't understand. You'll need to explain.
You wouldn't believe me if I told you. We're coming in now.
So what about this world between worlds? Well, Ahsoka was pulled into that world between worlds from a gateway by Ezra Bridger in one of the last few episodes of the Rebels series created by Dave Filoni. Of course, he's going back there, right? Dave is. Ahsoka was thought to have died at the end of season 2 of Rebels when she faced off against Vader and found out for sure that, yes, Anakin was the one that turned into Vader. So on Mortis, Vader's visage was seen while Anakin was wrestling with this prospect of taking over for the father, staying there on Mortis, I guess forever, to be the balance of the Force. So Ahsoka may have been killed on Malachor the first time she dueled with Vader, her former master, except we don't know that she ever did, because in the future, Ezra goes through this portal, there was Loth Wolves circling around, and then it opened up a doorway for him to walk through, and then he's walking around in that same space that Ahsoka is right now at the end of the episode, and then he finds a portal where he sees Ahsoka battling Vader, and he pulls her from that moment to save her.
Ahsoka!
She was able to go back to that place after Vader had left and the temple was no longer active. Then she was able to walk in the real world, ended up teaching Sabine. Apparently, as we heard, not letting her go back to Mandalore and, you know, die with her family, as Baylan Skoll told her, in the Night of a Thousand Tears. So who does Sabine have left? I mean, if she let herself consider Ahsoka family like Ahsoka clearly does to her, she wouldn't feel so alone. But that's also why I reject this idea she only loves Ezra like a brother. That's not passionate enough. That's not, you know, that's not a strong enough pull for someone who's not your actually family member and you've only known for a few years. Maybe if you've known someone your whole life, or maybe if you've gone through things like nobody else has gone through, and yes, they've had some hair-raising missions, but it's just not passionate enough, I don't think. And no matter how many times you tell me Leia kisses Luke to make Han mad, that, I mean, this, there's something romantic going on between in Ezra and Sabine's heart. I just have to believe that. And it's okay. I mean, they're old enough. It's not like it's weird. But for a Rebels watcher, it might be a little weird. Okay, so anyway, Ahsoka wakes in this world between worlds. How she got here, we're not shown. And I gotta believe that maybe it's a little bit of Force magic brought about by the proximity to what Baylan called this reflex point on Cetus, but Maybe we find out. Maybe a gate existed there that no one ever knew about or thought to explore. At any rate, she's there now. It's a very cool looking place. It's a cool live action representation of what was seen in Rebels. It's cooler than what was shown in Rebels. But as viewers of Rebels would know, there are these voices that can be heard from various points of the future and the past.
Truly wonderful, the mind of a child.
What is this place?
A conduit through which the entire force.
Luminous beings are we, not this truth matter. Train yourself to let go of everything you fear to lose.
What you need, you already have. Unfortunately, you seem to be letting it all go.
I won't let him lose his way. Not like I did.
Dave Filoni keeps saying, oh, it's not time travel. But that's the kind of thing someone says when they haven't done a good job of showing what their intention was, and then people end up calling it time travel. It's like that line from Game of Thrones.
I am the king! I will punish you.
Any man who must say I am the king is no true king.
In this case, Dave Filoni keeps telling people, oh, it's not really time travel, because everything he showed in Rebels makes this place look like time travel. So what's he going to do with this world between worlds? We're going to have to wait to find out, because Ahsoka hears the voice call out to her, one of her earliest nicknames from her master.
Hello, Snips.
Master?
So there are so many questions. Is this Anakin, or something that looks like him?
I didn't expect to see you so soon.
Is this truly the world between worlds? Or is it some other place? Is it like a netherworld place for Ahsoka? I mean, this is like the third time she's died, right? Maybe this is where Force users become Force ghosts. Is this how Palpatine survived falling into the Death Star? Now, in Rebels, we saw that he was getting close to unlocking the world between worlds. So maybe In the moment of his death, he finds the way. Is this what Qui-Gon Jinn discovered? Is this shimmering nature of this place on the floor, is that a function of projecting your essence throughout what Elsbeth called time and space? Maybe that's why Obi-Wan looks shimmering like that, and then Luke did, and Yoda did. Is this what Balin meant when he mentioned seeking true power? Answers are going to come, but maybe not to all of our questions. Here's the interesting thing about the trip that the Eye of Sion is taking here. They're searching for this ship that was derelict when the Star Whales, the Purgil, jumped with Ezra and Thrawn and the crew of the Chimera. That's the name of Thrawn's ship. That ship was disabled. They've either been out in this place for 10 to 15 years or so, drifting, running low on supplies. Maybe they found a planet or a place to establish a base. And either the crew of that ship has mostly survived, or maybe very few. But if they can't get back on their own, then the Eye of Sion is preparing to take that ship with that ring back, right? That ship can't fly very well, didn't have replacement parts to work with, but back how? Well, they're going to come back to the same place. It's not like they've got this alternate, oh, we're going to go to a secret place now. No, this, you know, all Hera has to do is either call on reinforcements with the help of Carson, whoever's left, Chopper, Jason, Hera. Maybe they have a recording of this ship going into hyperspace. Home One just sets up in orbit around or on the other side of CTOS, and they just sit there and wait. At worst, while CTOS orbits whatever star is in the system, maybe the coordinates don't take them back exactly to the orbit of CTOS, right? But the Eye of Sion is going to return somewhere in this system. The ship is heavily damaged, is returning. It's still not fixed. What seemed like days later to them, maybe, if it's a trip across time and space, or It's going to return damage with a crew that has been struggling to survive for 10 to 15 years. This is just a waiting game. They don't have to go searching for it. No one needs to follow it. It's coming back. It has to. They don't have an alternate map. The trip was so dangerous that they talked about calculations being off just a little bit would leave them in the void. So, unless there are people there at the other side already that have been making the trip before, they're coming back to that same place. And if there are already people there that have made that trip and come back, then why isn't Thrawn already back after 10 to 15 years? Thrawn would have found a way to return already.
Exactly.
I am absolutely looking forward to finding things out. I am intrigued. Part 5 comes out Tuesday, September 12th. And again, it's Tuesdays from here until Part 8, which I think is coming out on October 3rd, unless they pull a fast one on us. Dave Filoni will direct the next episode. That often indicates a big reveal is coming, since he likes to personally oversee characters he feels most connected to. It's hard to imagine there could be a bigger reveal than Anakin returning, but maybe there's more than meets the eye. Maybe he just wants to make sure his hands are on the returns of some of the characters that he created in Rebels. Alright, what are your thoughts about Ahsoka, the discussions of This Is The Way podcast? Do you have any ideas about what's going to happen now that through 4 episodes, we've reached the halfway point of an 8-episode season? You can send feedback or comments via email at thisisthewaypodcast@gmail.com. Yes, you can send it on Twitter or X or Instagram at thisisthewaypod or on facebook.com/thisisthewaypod. Our Linktree site has all the links at linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. If you want to be part of the discussion, you have to reach out. Thank you for joining me for the 4th episode of Ahsoka called Fallen Jedi. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is the way. May the Force be with you always.